Hello, I'm Lauren Fates, and this episode still wrecks me.
And I'm Jamie Sanchez. I will gladly devour a basket full of eggs.
Are you ready for the beat?
I'm ready for the beat.
Welcome back, bounty hunters, to another episode of the Bebop Beat. You can just tell the Netflix drop is coming with all of the new merch, all of the new announcements, all of the new photos. It is a big week for new stuff. First things first, new pic of John Cho. But the important thing about this picture, Jamie, is not John Cho at all. Did you notice what was in the background of the new production image?
It's our three old dudes. They're back.
It is. It's the three old guys. I saw someone point it out on Reddit and I got really excited and commented myself. I actually came out of lurk mode on Reddit just to say, I hate that I am such vulnerable fan trash for stuff like this, but this Easter egg did get me excited. I have to admit, I was thrilled to see them.
And I think that tracks too with all the new stuff coming out. Like an article came out a couple weeks ago from Polygon. With the showrunner Nemec, who stated like that Bebop is hallowed ground and let's not fuck it up. And that just kind of lights a spark in me. Like my hopes are getting higher and higher. And I don't know what to do, Lauren. This is tough.
Well, in the meantime, I feel like the fandom, or at least a vocal minority in the fandom, is trying to already find a way that they've fucked it up. Because these articles, you're right, they're trying so hard to say, this is respectful, you're going to love it, it's going to be just like the 90s, we did a great job, please just wait. And you've got people calling out the most random stuff, like the comic book that's coming out has all of these variant covers, and they're not my cup of tea, admittedly, they're not like my favorite art styles in the world, but people are trying to label them like some massive atrocity, like it's never happened in comics before, but y'all, ugly variant comics happen. That's just the thing.
Again, yeah, there are artistic decisions that are being made on the show and the ancillary materials that are happening. I can't love them all. And I actually have to state that this is also true of the street brand Bates' new line of Bebop clothing. I can't say I love it all. It's just stuff I wouldn't buy for myself. I can't imagine it in my wardrobe, even though I know some fans are real thrilled about it.
Well, I'm not a big brand name person, and most of the new line has the word bait across the front in that like tank primary color scheme. And so if you're into this brand, I think it's a delightful fusion, but I'm old and I've never heard of them before, so there's no reason for me to like wear it across my chest. I do have a secret though, and I did technically win the right to purchase raffle for one of the pairs of shoes that they released. And they're $120 and I haven't actually hit the buy button yet because the shoes just aren't that cool.
Oh no!
So I have for 48 more hours as of the day of this recording, I have two more days to decide if I want to cash in my quote unquote raffle win to buy these Cowboy Bebop shoes. But they're kind of plain, so I have to decide how much do I want to be a part of this? Do I want to be $120 a part of this?
I guarantee you that there is a close friend in our orbit who would absolutely love these shoes, so just jump on them.
And I could look at them and stare at them and hold them and decide if I want them, or maybe someone else with my size will want them instead. I think that's good. I think that you can give them to a friend theory makes it worth putting on my credit card, because it will be my credit card. Bounty hunters, we are so close to the end of the anime. I just can't believe it. And today we're covering what is, in my opinion, the most emotional episode. This is Hard Luck Woman. We see the end of not one, but two, arguably three character stories all at once. We also get to hear some of the show's best songs from our friend Steve Conti. And we really wanted to take a perhaps a therapeutic angle this week because, gosh, I needed to talk to my therapist about this one. This is a rough ride.
So please welcome to the show, Brian Kundi. a private practice therapist and consultant that specializes in geek culture. He works with gamer organizations such as GamerX and Take This. Thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me, Jamie and Lauren.
So I was introduced to you by Dr. B at Take This and told emphatically that you were the right person for this job. Perhaps you could tell us what drew you to Cowboy Bebop and why you still love it today.
So I have always been a big noir geek. I am a sucker for Sam Spade bullshit. I'll watch the Maltese Falcon. I'll watch Casablanca. I will do it on the big screen if it's at a local theater. You know, it's not a pandemic. I'll go out of my way for this kind of stuff. And then you added the space opera like layer to that. It was like everything coming together. I knew about Cowboy Bebop initially because I was an anime kid in the early aughts with like Akon and Dallas and stuff like that. But I didn't have cable. But I did end up working at a unnamed buy-sell trade game store at the end of high school. And, you know, they used to sell DVDs then, and I would buy these whole box sets as we either trade in or they had them for sale. And Bebop was one of the first full series I collected. And I'd watch that on loop through my like late teens.
So we really wanted to find somebody who knew geek culture and could speak to some of these titles, speak to some of these mindsets, these fandom spaces. I personally, I do have a therapist. She's not my first therapist. And I think every single time I have to do some like labor, laying the groundwork to be like, okay, before I can tell you what's going on, this is what anime is. And then this is what an anime convention is. And then there's this thing called cosplay. And this is how people react to cosplay. And next thing you know, like session over. So for you, what is the most gratifying aspect about doing this work in fandom spaces? And how do you think this intersection you have benefits your clients?
It's a great question. I mean, from my side of things, in geek and fandom spaces, there's just this fantastic energy. People are excited about these things. They're excited about their communities. A lot of the consulting work I actually do is on diversity and inclusion. In these community spaces, folks really want to see their community thrive. They want to bring that energy to the space, and they really want to make things better. And I don't run into that a lot in that kind of consulting. Normally, you think of diversity training, right? This is the thing your job makes you do. It's a PowerPoint. It's boring. It's because we have to, because there's a law. But in geek spaces, it's because folks really want to make things the best they could possibly be. On the other side of things, in my clinical practice, it's been a fantastic way to build rapport with folks. I do a lot of clients, Lauren, like you described, come in and they think they have to explain all of these things. And once I have shown them that they can skip past most of that with me and get right to the work and I get it, like, you know, why did my social anxiety do this very specific thing at this big convention that, you know, most therapists are like, why did you start with a big convention? Well, because it was important. You have to go to this thing. It's a social event of the year, right? It's just makes for a better therapeutic relationship. We get more work done faster.
So to the general public, they might have a perception that gaming spaces are more toxic or challenging than they might automatically believe, considering what the news has told them or what popular culture is saying. Have you faced any kind of challenges like this personally in transforming gamer and fan communities? Or have you found that these spaces have been way more receptive and helpful with your mission?
Generally, folks want what's best for their community and their fandom. A lot of times when folks are being, like gatekeeping, I think is a good phrase for what you're describing. They have this high bar to entry. They're very prickly towards folks who don't get it. And some of that, they just don't want to do the work of explaining it, like Lauren talked about. It's a lot of work. For others, this is a thing that for them, they see as theirs in sometimes ways that are unhelpful. We think a lot about the lack of conversation of mental health and mental wellness in geek culture spaces. And I think that's because for many folks, these spaces and hobbies have been such huge coping skills for them for things they've not been given any other tools to deal with. And worse, they may go to a mental health professional who sees these things as detriments, not as strengths. And that causes a lot of problems because there's a lot of threat response to that. Usually when folks come to me really wanting to do better, but feeling uncomfortable, they need a space where they can express that and feel safe in doing it. But they also need to be held accountable for the ways that, you know, they can't treat other people. They can't be aggressive. They can't be violent. They can't threaten folks, things like that. And that's also a hard thing because maybe no one's really shown them that's not a thing you can do and had real consequences.
To support that notion, what do you think these spaces or communities themselves can do to come closer to reaching that vision and to promote inclusivity and mental wellness and even just like basic respect, like you were saying? It can be hard to play a video game online with the way people treat each other. Like you said, it can be really hard to go to a big convention that's just filled with so many people. I think maybe enforced harassment policy is a great example. What are some other things you'd like to see these spaces do?
And absolutely. And the first one, I always say there needs to be a written and enforced anti-harassment policy. And the difference between having a harassment policy, right, and enforcing it is you can say these are the rules, but if no one loses access to the event for breaking them, if no one is ejected from the event for breaking them, they don't mean anything. Folks just continue their bad behavior. I think the other thing that needs to happen is folks need to start having difficult conversations with their friends. We all have those friends, right, in geek spaces where, you know, we just don't think about their behavior or their words. We sort of just like it's the background radiation to this culture. Then we have that new person show up, right? And suddenly we're kind of embarrassed. We realize how bad this looks and sounds because we've just let it keep going. What that friend really needed wasn't for us to let them keep going. It was to have a really gentle conversation, sort of call them in about how we love them. We want them to be in this space, but the things they're doing and saying have got to change for us to keep doing that. Otherwise, other folks can't enjoy this too. I also think the companies need to start taking a lead. A lot of toxic gaming culture comes out of a failure to set appropriate cultural norms from day one. We talk a lot about certain online games that are very toxic versus ones that aren't. And the common denominator is which ones nip this behavior in the bud from day one and which ones did not. Which ones don't allow this kind of behavior on a corporate level and which ones do. It mirrors very closely when you look at the ones that are succeeding at this and the ones that are struggling or even failing.
In recent experience with conventions, I have been seeing a prevalence of folks who are willing to have these kind of talks, really bring it and make it real. Gamer X is an inclusive convention geared towards the LGBTQ community. You know, Take This is a nonprofit organization that's bringing mental wellness and the discussion of it and awareness of it to convention spaces. I know that there's another organization known as Anime for Humanity doing the same for anime conventions. So why do you think these organizations are important and why do you choose to put your time and energy into supporting them?
Well, I think most importantly, I love this culture and this hobby. I think a lot about geek culture and my hobbies as a teenager and the ways they supported me through a lot of very difficult parts of my life. And to think that we could have these spaces and not everyone could access that kind of support and community, that's a terrible thing to think about. And when I meet folks who are doing the same kind of work, they're kind of coming from the same stance, is we want everyone to have this thing that we got out of it. And we realize as things are now, certain folks are kept from getting that who want it, love it, benefit from it. And while it is work to get us there, it's actually not that much work. We just have to do it.
So it's really great to be seeing these organizations having a presence at conventions and reaching out to the general public that attends them, connecting them with the mental wellness resources that they need. But we know there are many barriers to entry for lots of people who could really use a talk with a therapist or just someone to connect with and improve their mental wellness. What barriers do you see currently in the way of making that happen?
I mean, the big one we talk about a lot is, of course, access to equitable healthcare, right? Therapy is expensive. Finding a therapist who's a fit is really expensive. I don't take insurance, for example. It's just too cumbersome for me. But the bigger piece on the professional side has really been normalizing these hobbies and interests as totally routine things and even strengths. You know, just over 10 years ago, I was in a class at a very well-respected graduate program where I had a professor who told me playing Dungeons and Dragons was a sign of psychopathology in children. And she couldn't back it up with research because she was still buying into the satanic panic of the late 80s, early 90s. Even though we know in psychiatric and psychological research, they later on checked like this has nothing to do with what happened there. These incidents brought up by the news were not actually connected to the game. They were connected to this person's untreated mental illness. And I tell that story a lot to demonstrate that mental health care professions are still working on seeing geek culture as another culture to be competent in, just like military veterans, just like different religions, just like race and ethnicity, and on and on and on. This is a culture. You need to learn how to engage with it. And Take This has done a lot of work on the other side of things with the profession to begin building that body of research, to begin sort of picking apart some of these not so great arguments, not as rooted in science, versus just a misunderstanding of what geek culture is like.
The episode Hard Luck Woman is yet another music reference. It is a Kiss song. And the episode itself opens with Faye on a mental health journey of her own. She is doing this by herself. She's just trying to watch the video of herself as a child over and over again. She's pausing on different images, and it's clear, even though there's no dialogue here, that she's trying to jog her own memory. She wants to remember her past. Turns out, Radical Edward is in the room, kind of sleepwalking, and says she might know the location. The waterfall in the picture, maybe she's seen it before, maybe she hasn't. So Faye decides to take Ed and, of course, without telling the guys, leave the Bebop and try to find this place for herself.
In typical Faye fashion, though, she takes over the Bebop. They were on course to Mars, and she turns that entire ride around to Earth.
I did look at the background of this scene, trying to see if Faye's room had any other cool character building stuff to spot. And even though it's a nicely drawn image, there's very few specific telling items in the background. There's just like ship parts and such. But there is one shopping bag from a store called New Moon. And I just love that Faye still got her mall fix somewhere recently. It's very cool. You're absolutely right, though, Jamie. When we cut to Jet and Spike, Jet has no idea why they're on Earth or what the point of this is. They were apparently chasing a bounty, and Spike is trying to have a peaceful morning. I really like this image of himself, like, drinking coffee and looking over the water, brushing his teeth, doing the whole routine. And Jet just rushes in with the dog with this totally different energy. It's a very cute moment for even just their relationship.
So Faye's been on this discovery to surface her memories since she woke from cryosleep. It's been really long and tough on her, and she's adopted this really hard edge, you know, femme fatale exterior to protect her from this world she knows nothing about and the people who are trying to extract her debt from her. This is one episode that really gets into the vulnerability of Faye. This is an aspect of her personality we haven't seen since Speak Like a Child. And it really, from the get-go, I was tearing up, like, immediately. We played the intro and I heard Tank. And then, like, within the first 2 seconds of Faye looking at that videotape, my eyes were watering, Lauren.
I feel you. This episode wrecks me too, like I said in the intro. And I think it's partially because we've been watching this anime with such an analytical eye for this podcast. And even the previous episode, Brain Scratch, which I previously didn't pull that much from, suddenly it's coloring the episode after it. Faye and, as we will soon see, Ed are both seeking belonging, at least partially as a result from their, like, cults and extremism experiences. That was such a traumatic time that this is the response. Faye pulls that video back out. And it's a lot more heavy, I think, when you're just watching it straight through.
So, Brian, it's pretty clear that Lauren and I are really hung up over this episode. Does it hit the mark for you? Do you land in our territory, or do you feel differently about this episode?
Oh, absolutely. What's really interesting for me rewatching old media is a lot of this stuff, like I said, I watched in, you know, undergrad and college before I had any mental health training, before I spent a bunch of time doing crisis work or work with young people. I worked exclusively with children and adolescents for, gosh, I would say a good 5 or 6 years. And rewatching this, it really began to hit home, or that search for identity. They're so desperate to figure out who they are. And I think I looked at Scratch before that on the DVD and went, oh yeah, this came right after that episode. Oh, that hits real different now. Because what cults do, we know in mental health, is they break down your identity and rebuild it to something that fits their model. And so Ed and Faye have survived that, but they're left with no more answers than when they started. And cults generally target folks who have sort of a less strong sense of self. They're questioning things. You know, and Ed is vaguely a teenager. So that's something Ed is working out. It's like, you know, who am I? Faye has kind of been stuck at 2022, really, since she woke up, because she has no point of reference. She has nothing to look back on for who she is. So chronologically, you know, she's finished brain development. She's in her mid-20s, but she still has no firm sense of self. And it's heartbreaking to watch her with that video. She doesn't have to say anything, but you know exactly what she's doing in her head.
Unfortunately for Faye, Ed gets some answers first. Ed kind of is being tricky and wants to take Faye back to a very specific place. We do get a glimpse of the bounty in the amphibious vehicle that is mapping craters, but we'll get there in a minute. The destination that this scene quickly turns to is really visually interesting, and it's got like almost a Dickensian sadness for me too. It's like a landfill in a crater where they're dumping rock rubble, but then there's also an orphanage there. So Faye gets surrounded by kids, and the kids don't seem to think they have like a terrible hard knock life, if you will. There's robot kid and silverware kid and collecting nails kid. Kids are very weird, but they seem just pretty happy, all things considered. And this is where Ed is, at least for a while, from. Ed was not born here, but the people here remember her. Before we get to that, though, I was curious. These kids are such weirdos. They have such weird hobbies. Do either of you remember, like, what was your weird kid collection or your weird kid fixation?
I was all about Lisa Frank. Like, rainbows everywhere. Gotta get me the hologram stickers. Yeah.
I think mine was probably Super Nintendo games, which I don't think is, like, crazy for that age. Like, and neither was Lisa Frank. I think those were two very, like, 90s things to be into. But I know I was the kid railroading conversations that were about something else to be about Nintendo games, because this was where I was comfortable. This is the thing that I knew. So I don't know pop music lyrics. Can we please talk about Super Mario Brothers? That's what I want to have a conversation about.
Before Pokemon, I was a big Redwall kid, the books by Brian Jocks about, like, woolly animals who are murdering each other, which I say it as an adult, and you're just like, oh yeah, that's kind of messed up. But yeah, I would read these, like, 400-page books at, like, age 10, just because it was my weird thing as a kid. One of many. It was just the first.
But can't you just imagine that trio? Like, here's Faye Valentine, and the three of us are like, look at my rainbow leopard folder. Do you want to play video games? I have a book about animals murdering each other. It's the exact same vibe. Like, we have nailed it.
I also want to add that this is likely the orphanage that Tomato was also from the manga chapter. So a nice little hook in there to bring everything to a close.
If you're one of those people that watches TV while looking at your phone or looking at your computer like I do, definitely look up at this point, not only to see, like, Robot Kid's weird robot, but also the pinwheels. This orphanage is decorated with colorful spinning pinwheels, and that just touched my heart so much. It's like a really cheap but whimsical piece of decor that they can put up to, like, add color, bring a little bit of that childlike wonder, and I think just to brighten up the fact that they seem to be living in rubble. It's almost a comfort, like a visual comfort.
It was interesting for me rewatching this after I'd spent a couple of years working for an emergency children's shelter, because I haven't watched this since my early 20s all the way through. And it really hit me how much this reminded me of that work in those ways, like the small ways you brighten up kind of a dreary or institutional space, that you make the best of it. These kids are trying to find joy in just the littlest, weirdest things, because that's how they're getting through all of this.
And that's true of Sister Clara, too, right? She's definitely making lemonade out of lemons. And you can see that in her short little prayer that she concludes with, never mind the rest, like, time to dig in.
It doesn't seem like there's anyone else there. There's this nun who appears to be sort of a Catholic identifying nun, and nobody else. A story that I think I'd be very interested in hearing either as a piece of manga or maybe in a prequel novel, I'm looking at you, Netflix, is how did she get into this situation? Did it used to be a much more bustling, beautiful place? And then through meteors and sort of destruction, did it become like this? Or is she the person who alone built this organization up out of nothing, and this is all it's ever been? Either way, she's a boss.
Oh yeah, her by herself with like 10 kids, that's boss mode. Having done that work, I was like two for every eight at least.
So at this point, Ed gets to join all the kids for dinner, and this is probably the first exchange they've had in the 3 years that she's been gone. And Sister Clara says, I've got something good for you. Check the drawer. And Ed goes over to the drawer and pulls out this hologram portrait of her father. And it occurs to me, she hasn't seen this man since she was the age of 6 years old. So she's got this look of confusion on her face, and she doesn't know what to make of it. And I think this was the first watch through that I realized, like I put all those pieces together, that she doesn't know who this person is in her life.
Right. The timeline, it's not just 3 years. 3 years was when Ed left the orphanage, but her father forgot, I guess, that he put her in daycare 7 years ago. So it really has been a long time. I don't want to get into like making assumptions about this character that aren't, in the script. But what do we think the deal is with Ed's dad? Is it abandonment? Like, or is it honestly just being so distracted that he forgot her? Either way, it's abusive, but well-meaning forgetfulness versus malicious abandonment. I guess there are two different flavors there.
I mean, I definitely define it as neglect. It would meet just about any state's definition of neglect of a child. You left your child in care and just never came back. We also never really see much of a government on Earth. Even in Carolyn Tuesday, there's not much of one mentioned. There's also sort of a question, is anyone even going after Dad to say, hey, here is your child?
No, and we clearly, when we meet him later, he is so obsessed with his mission to save Earth through the power of maps that it's wild to think that he would forget his own daughter just because she was inconvenient to the mission. I suspect there's probably some more traumatic elements underneath. We'd never meet a mother. It's possible that could play into it, but we definitely don't want to speculate about the well-being or diagnose fictional characters. And Brian actually raised this to my attention, and I would love to know why.
Yeah, so I'll go and preface this with a lot of programs that train mental health professionals do ask us as an exercise to diagnose a fictional character. It was a pretty common project in my clinical diagnosis class to be handed a movie and, you know, diagnose the cast as the more dysfunctional, the better, right? But when we talk about diagnosing fictional characters openly, like on a podcast, we really avoid it as a profession. And there's two reasons. The first is that we're only getting this tiny slice of a character on screen or on page. Jamie, you made a really good point that there's so much information we just never get about Ed's dad or Ed's mother or the circumstances that Ed was going through prior to leaving care. We don't know what was going on that led Ed to leave for 3 years and then decide to come back. The other thing to consider here as well is that oftentimes characters' health or mental health is written in service to a larger story, right? We don't get more story on Ed because the series is ending. There is no time to continue this narrative. And really, I would argue that part of that's because Ed really isn't compatible with what comes next, not in terms of tone or happy endings or other endings.
And I would love to put a button in that for our discussion a little later.
Absolutely. Some of the other reasons that we don't generally diagnose fictional characters in public spaces is that diagnosis is a long and ongoing process. A standard assessment to start care can be 90 to 120 minutes just to get a good guess. A full psychological evaluation can range from 4 to 8 hours of testing, and we often only do them when we're stuck and realize that we're not finding a good diagnosis with the available information or tools. They're very expensive to do because they're so labor intensive. And most importantly, fictional characters aren't diagnostic tools. Often when we assign a diagnosis to a fictional character that the creative team hasn't made explicit, folks will tend to use that character as a way to figure out, is this what's going on with me? Is this something I'm going through? And it can lead them to the wrong conclusions and get in the way of them getting any care or assistance they need.
To that point, I do have concerns about the folks in some of the Facebook groups, Cowboy Bebop Facebook groups, who very much align with Spike and his personality and see them as a personal hero. I think maybe that's not so healthy, but I also hope that they're seeking the appropriate help they need.
American media is full of characters who people really idolize, and I don't think you were supposed to idolize them. Like, whether we're talking about Sopranos or Breaking Bad, and people are like, oh, I love Mr. White, I'm going to be him. No, don't be Walter White. Actually, that wasn't what you were supposed to get out of this.
I think it's important to see yourself in the media you consume and have characters you identify with and whose struggles can help you make sense of your own. When it comes to a medical diagnosis, that's a pretty tall order. And a lot of folks don't realize this, but most physical health diagnoses, we know exactly what it is. There's very clear tests. But in psychological diagnoses, we often start with the diagnosis that fits best, and we'll have a little field called R/O, means rule out. And it means that I list the things that it might be, but we aren't completely sure yet. I need to prove it isn't these to support it's the one I think it is. We call it differential diagnosis. And it's a long process. We really do wish it was faster. We wish we had better tools to know things right away. We just don't yet. And giving a character a mental health diagnosis that's not textual can often lead folks to misunderstanding this process.
I also don't want to overreach my own expertise, but when it comes to especially this episode, there are things in these characters' reactions and their behavior that I just think is normal. Like, when you've gone through trauma or you've just gone through something really sad, sometimes it is normal to just go through a funk or be upset or go through a dark period. And it doesn't mean there's something like chemically or diagnosably wrong with you. You're just going through a hard time. And with Cowboy Bebop especially, most of the time we spend with these people is a hard time. So it would be, I think, you'd be really amiss to try and take this period in these characters' lives and say, there's a diagnosis you can make for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that's always stuck with me from some of my clinical training for children is that most of the time, people are not behaving irrationally. They're having a very rational response to an irrational situation.
To put kind of a funny period at the end of that sentence, I'd like to share an irrational fear of mine that comes up in this episode. Faye is given some soup, and it is fish soup, and it has a whole fish in it. And one of the funniest stories from my former marriage is when I discovered that I have a phobia of whole animals that are put in front of me as food. And so if it has like eyes or a face, I experience a really intense fight or flight reaction. In fact, my cheeks, you can see them turning red right now because I'm just thinking about it. And I wrote it down in my notes, like, if I got that soup Faye got, I would have run away from the table. And that, folks, is an irrational response.
Out of curiosity, do you know why fish are eaten whole, at least in Chinese culture? It's actually considered good luck.
I had no idea.
Which I think is very interesting, because I remember in this episode, Faye is the one given a bowl of soup with the whole fish. It's considered a gesture of, I think at some point, you're our guest. That was my read on it, at least, and we want good things for you.
That's really amazing.
So during one of my rewatches of this episode in the past, I was watching with a good friend of mine who actually spent extended time living in Singapore. And if you recall, during Faye's beta tape watch through, we see a merlion statue. And my friend was like, instantly, that's Singapore. I know where she lives. Like, and it really colored my viewing of not only Faye's heritage or perspective, but also just kind of getting a sense of where we are on Earth this episode.
That's true. Faye is Singaporean. That's a known canonical fact and something that a lot of people comment on when compared to the Netflix casting. But my observation is, dang, then, isn't that a really huge coincidence that Ed also just had like a significant period of her life take place there? Huh.
Bebop is nothing but coincidences.
It's a noir trope, though, right? Like all these coincidences that have brought us together to this point, to this end. They never fully get explained. They just happen.
So finally, Faye gets to start exploring her part of the story when a woman named Sally Young approaches Faye. Sally is an elderly woman. She's in a wheelchair, and she sees Faye and is sort of frightened. They apparently went to high school together, and for a second, Sally thinks this must be some sort of ghost because Faye looks the same. However, Faye doesn't even need to correct her. Sally just sort of reasons through it, and she says, "Oh yes, you were put into cryogenic hibernation after that terrible accident." One question I had from this moment is, shouldn't Sally Young know Faye's last name? It's confirmed in this moment that Faye's actual name is Faye, but the doctor that unfroze her gave her the name Valentine. I'm really shocked that Sally Young doesn't say, "Faye, whatever, we never get to learn that." Sally does go, "Oh my gosh, you don't remember," and then proceeds to, like, not be helpful. But Faye doesn't really allow it either, I guess. The granddaughter comes up, Faye says she's a ghost, and then she grabs Ed as if Ed was just like a piece of luggage and goes off into the day.
One aspect of this scene that really stuck with me is when Sally says they say ghosts appear in places where they have regrets. And regret has always implied to me that Faye had a choice in her situation, which clearly isn't the case. She does have a lot of these kind of old ties she's searching for. She's searching where she belongs. And yet she has this opportunity to follow Sally, perhaps, and really hunt down, like, what is my last name? Where did I live? This woman could have given her answers. And yet here we are.
Something I noticed this time was that in this moment, Ed is riding on top of the Zipcraft, even though earlier in the episode, she was tied to it. And so there's some message there about now that they've both kind of gotten some answers, the trip is a little less fraught. Maybe they trust each other a little bit more. They're a little bit more comfortable because now Ed just gets to ride on top of the ship instead of getting strapped to it. I don't know. I want something to be there. I want there to be a point to it.
Well, you get that when they enter the Bebop and Jet is automatically going on a rampage like, "What have you done, Faye? Why are we here? What's going on?" And both of the girls are silent. It's very clear that they've just experienced something very impactful in their lives. And neither Jet nor Spike know what's going on.
Jet is so in the dark about this that at several points during the episode, he implies that maybe the girls are just too hungry. And maybe this is all just his fault because they're starving. And right as they're about to arrive, he's had this like revelation that maybe if he feeds them sukiyaki with real meat, maybe they'll be okay. And I just thought that was very precious that Jet is still trying to be the dad.
I mean, at least it's the sexism we see from him and Spike occasionally, but it's for like, "I just want to take care of you." It's a little paternal, so it's not as bad. But yeah, for me, it's that moment of, do they have feelings, Jet? Women have feelings.
I'm glad that you are comfortable calling out the casual sexism because it's there. It's often.
Yeah, like I said, my rewatch of this is post my clinical training, and there's these moments of, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, no. I hope the Netflix series doesn't do this. Really hope it doesn't.
Quick side note, Spike is reading a book in this moment called Walking on the Moon, and that is probably a reference to a song by The Police. So it is a song by The Police and also just a space reference because this is sci-fi.
So other things we hope the Netflix adaptation does or doesn't do. Brian, you have opinions, correct?
Oh, yes.
Please share.
Yes. We're on that note. I think my biggest success so far is that Faye has pants. Thank God Faye has pants. No one's buying that outfit. No one's buying it for driving a space fighter. No one's buying it for bounty hunting work. It makes for like weird or cool costumes or art, but I just can't imagine, especially with like the nightgown in a My Funny Valentine. Like, she clearly knows how to dress herself very well to this outfit that makes absolutely no sense. The jacket never stays on. That's the big one. I do have some hopes for that we'll get a more nuanced examination of Ed. There's a very strong reading of Ed as, at the very minimum, somewhere in the umbrella of genderqueer, somewhere in the umbrella of neurodiverse, but we didn't have those words for those things then. We didn't have a bigger cultural conversation. I think I remember what made Bebop so transgressive in the late 90s was having like on-screen queer people exist. I think a lot about that scene that was deleted from the American broadcast where Faye walks in on two men in coitus and it's not even commented upon. This is just a thing. And that was huge in, you know, 97, 98, especially for, you know, anime.
So far, we're speculating that Ed will appear at the end of season one as some kind of sting, but...
Oh, I don't know about that anymore.
Oh, really, Lauren? Tell me.
In the two articles that we referenced on an earlier episode, I think two episodes ago, there's much bigger hints that there is Ed. Like, somebody, one of the interviewees, when asked about Ed, said, I think the fans will be delighted with what we've done. And it feels like if it were just an end sting to be like, ah, oh, fans are going to be delighted, that feels like an overreaction, but it's definitely going to be Ed. I think that's confirmed.
I think there's probably an awareness that Ed is a character who, if they mess up, could be really, really bad. And so they may be very careful about this. And we know from a lot of geek culture stuff, right, when they hint at LGBTQ content and it's done out of context or it's done for a marketing thing, it doesn't always land the way they want it to. So this could be strategic.
That's a fair assessment I hadn't considered before.
You were brushing up against this earlier, just even the fact that Ed is a literal child. I don't know how well her presence will work in a live-action, apparently quite violent adult show. I think anime gets away with younger characters and weirder, you know, family arrangements, if you will, because it's anime. I mean, you have Tenchi Muyo and harem anime as an example. They'll throw whoever into a house. But once it's a live-action Netflix show and people are shooting each other and bleeding, it's a lot harder to imagine Ed around for the adventure all the time.
No, I agree. And I think that's a good thing to do. I don't think keeping Ed at the edge we see her at in the anime is really going to land. Because at some point, right, these adults are housing, 13, 14-year-old? And a very violent lifestyle. It's not going to work out long term. But maybe an older Ed, an Ed who's a young adult, 16, 17, 18, that may be more viable.
I'd even considered that the young actress who is currently on IMDb as a character with the last name Black and is allegedly maybe Jet's daughter, I've kind of wondered if that's actually a head fake and it's really Ed.
I mean, it's very possible that Jet adopted Ed in this particular take on the show, which makes it a little less scary.
Faye is back on the Bebop, taking a shower, and suddenly, that drowning imagery back from Mushroom Samba, it kind of comes back in a way, in that the shower water at her feet suddenly becomes the coastal water off of the beach in Singapore. We see her eyes get this look of realization, and in her mind, she can see everything. She sees her friends in school, and she sees her childhood and happiness. But she also sees a scary scene, the accident, in which I believe her parents are sitting next to her on a spacecraft. The gravity goes out, the windows shatter, there's an explosion. One of the questions I had in this watch through that I didn't have before was, what do we think the survival rate of this accident was? I think it's implied that everyone dies and Faye's the only survivor. But given how strange it is in the first place that Faye survives at all, maybe not. So what do you guys think?
So if we dial back to the episode My Funny Valentine, where we see Faye cryogenically unthawed from hibernation, we presume they're in a giant freezer of sorts. They're sub-zero temperatures. So there's scientists who are extracting the capsule she lives in and removing her in a very anime-esque kind of scene. This doesn't really tell us much of anything, though. All those capsules could be other people who have, you know, living wills or what have you that also state they want to be cryogenically frozen. It could tell us that this is just a common practice for people who can very clearly afford it and maybe the poor cannot. And so all we have are assumptions, I think, here. But it's clear from the portrayal of the explosion itself that things are dire and that she likely has nothing to return to.
Speaking of this being a thing wealthy people can afford, I really started wondering this watch through if Faye's parents or at least their wills, paid for the cryogenic freezing. I'm not necessarily certain either of the parents got the same treatment, if they were even able to. But I started suspecting with the size of Faye's house that she really came from some money, and maybe this was the plan. You know, if anyone in our family ever qualifies for this, we're going to throw some money at the problem and keep ourselves going. I know that Brian had some interesting thoughts about whether that's actually in good faith or if that's an effective thing to do for people.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a long history in the U.S. of putting people into institutionalized care, usually for developmental disabilities, mental health issues, things like that. Sometimes for totally addressable physical disabilities as well. And we've long since discontinued that practice for very obvious reasons. But during these periods, families would essentially forget these family members in care, especially if someone like their primary caregivers were managing the day-to-day of payment, maintaining this care, visits, dies, and no one quite knows where these people are or doesn't have the legal authority to do anything. But on the other side of that, no medical profession is going to simply turn these folks loose or let them die. In mental health care even, the state hospital system in Texas, when it deinstitutionalized, had to actually take this graveyard here in Austin that belonged to the state for folks who were never claimed by their families, and it became a years-long project of graduate students at the University of Texas to find the living relatives of these deceased and have them moved to the appropriate burial plots. That graveyard still exists because there's still a couple dozen they could never find any living connections to. And this was a common practice through about the 80s in the United States.
I emphasize that this is not canonical. This is just us kind of spitballing. But I actually do think then there's a rational through line there, that she ended up frozen based on the good intent and wealth of her family who loved her and wanted her to have a future. But then when she had nobody, then she sort of fell through the cracks and ended up scammed. I think it can be both.
Yeah, for lack of a legal guardian or representative, I can absolutely see how that trio was able to get a hold of her body and start that grift. No one was there to stop them.
There's a special hell for Whitney Haggis Matsumoto. Just reminding everybody of that. So this is one of the most salient scenes in the entire show. It hits every single note. We feel all these feels, but we have to wonder. One, we assume Faye is suffering from the clinical version of amnesia. And Brian, is this actually a reasonable assessment, or what else should we be considering there?
Well, in the first question, I think anyone does ask and can ask, is this just the trauma of the events, right? I think Faye absolutely qualifies for what we call complex trauma, meaning we're not just talking one traumatic event. We're talking several and different parts of her life. She has been scammed. She's lost everyone she's ever known. She doesn't know who she is. She is drowning in debt. The moment she wakes up, she has no idea what this world is anymore. All these traumas all at once. And she doesn't have any foundation to stand on. That doesn't really hold up. We know that post-traumatic stress disorder does alter our hippocampus, which is a part of our brain that governs memory and learning. But typically, this means we have trouble learning or remembering new things. And we have trouble recalling accurate events, usually of the traumatic incident. Details will be hard for us to remember. And that's more wrapped up in our brain's sort of automatic response of, oh, I'm thinking a scary thing is happening again. We're going to go into crisis mode. We're not doing that thing where we process a memory and put it away all the way. That's not what's happening. Faye is not having flashbacks to this accident throughout the series. She struggles to even remember what exactly happened to get her here until this point. The other place where amnesia often shows up on a long-term basis is a thing called a traumatic brain injury. And that is a class of what's called neurocognitive disorders. These are things where something has happened to your brain to alter your emotional and practical functioning. But generally, this kind of amnesia doesn't last more than about a week, except in severe brain trauma. And that's also kind of tricky, because normally in severe brain trauma, we see other problems, motor skill deficits, language deficits, huge difficulties managing emotions and anger. Faye is prickly, but Faye has a good reason to be prickly with people. It has nothing to do with the way her brain is or isn't structured. So really, I began thinking a lot about, as I watched this episode, what are the ways she could have had essentially traumatic brain damage? But it could have been the explosion, It could have been the oxygen deprivation from exposure to a vacuum. She was clearly in a spacecraft that was early in design, didn't have a lot of safety things to sort of cushion her against this incident. The tents at a lot and the dogfights, as long as the capsules are intact, people are generally going to be okay without a vacuum suit. The medical procedure itself could have actually caused this damage. The doctor, when he wakes her up in My Funny Valentine, talks about cells dividing and seems to hint there's some sort of regenerative therapy going on. Well, it's possible there was brain damage and they were able to repair it, but repairing damaged tissue in the brain doesn't bring back connections that were lost. It could have even just been the cryosleep. Maybe cryosleep was never designed for someone to be in it for 55 years. There could be a degradation over time. So really my takeaway is that it was probably something related to the explosion, but it's so specific, we don't have enough information to really know.
Those are all really fascinating points. And I do often go back to what our director loves to do, which is make the cool thing happen and write the thing as clear-cut as possible for the sake of storytelling. So point the second, do we believe that this portrayal of Faye's memories resurfacing was realistic or not? Do we believe the creatives could have handled this differently? And what should Netflix take away from that?
Well, I will say this. I do love the way they show us how overwhelmed Faye is by all of these things as they begin to come up. She can't even move in the shower. She can't even move from her bed. She can just only hit repeat, repeat, repeat on this video. Faye's behavior is not unlike my clinical experiences with folks who have had traumatic brain injuries. Things that we may think are very routine and easy to process and discuss can be incredibly overwhelming as they try to make sense of it, essentially without connections they know are supposed to be there, but just aren't anymore. That said, like I mentioned, I find it incredibly hard to believe they had this level of traumatic brain injury and had all her motor skills, all her language skills. She was able to learn a new era. She taught herself how to pilot a starfighter. I would hope in the Netflix series, maybe we get a Faye who is getting bits and pieces of her past that don't make any sense to her in response to random stimuli, a smell, a picture, a word. That drowning motif again was like she's going under for a moment and doesn't know why and can't make sense of it. That would be a little closer to the kinds of ways people get memories back when these things happen. It's like going down a staircase in the dark. Once you kind of know where the stairs are, it's easy, but for a long time, it's slow and it's terrifying.
Faye does seem two completely different emotions in quick succession after this happens. She runs into Spike in the hallway, and I do think she seems scared. She says she's sorry, and Spike looks at her like she's never apologized to anyone in her entire life. Like, this is a jarring moment, and she sticks by it. She's like, yep, I am sorry. The look on her face, she's just completely shaken by what has just happened to her. I do see fear there. Then she grabs her, like, teal and pink caboodles bag, and she looks like she's experiencing euphoria. Ed comes and is asking where she's going, and Faye's like, I'm going where I belong. Belonging is the best thing there is. You have somewhere you belong to. You should go find it. And this is another scene that hits me really differently now. I remember watching this as a teen and feeling happy for her and hopeful. I was like, finally, she's whole again. Her life is going to get better. I'm really excited for what happens to Faye. This time, I can't rationally be excited for her. And it's not just because I know what happens in the episode. It's not just that. It's the fact that I think it's already pretty clear that she has nowhere to go. When she says she's going to where she belongs, where does she think that is? It can't be her house. Her parents are likely not alive. And I think we actually know already that what she's about to do is going to be tragic. There's not just a school or a house or a community that was frozen with her that's waiting. It doesn't exist.
Yeah, and I think that's really where I need to break out the tissues every time this episode. It never hits different for me. It's always that really sad realization that she's hoping that there's a past frozen waiting for her. Not only is she excited by this idea, but she's also empowering Ed to find where she belongs. And that's a double duty like statement right there. My goodness. So she plants this idea that Ed should be with her father, and Ed's gears start turning. And there's something that clicks with me, at least when I watch that entire interaction, that Ed suddenly realizes that she doesn't belong at the Bebop, where she's always made herself home.
Yeah, not to put too fine a point on it, but there's an interpretation of this where Faye is saying that Ed should go back to an abuser. I don't think Appleberry is portrayed as, like, actively abusive, but the way he does not give a shit about Ed, it's not going to be a fulfilling and loving life to send this kid back to him. And I think that happens a lot from well-meaning friends or well-meaning outsiders. I have, frankly, a little bit of personal experience in this area where, like, I used to be married and a lot of people were just really rooting for us to get back together, for it to work out. And that sort of recommendation, even though the people around you think they're saying something nice, it's not always actually the best recommendation for you. And I think Faye is making a bad call. Like, if Faye could be with her parents, she would. But that doesn't necessarily mean Ed should be with her parents. It's not the right fit for everybody.
Yeah, this is hard because in my experience with young people who have been abused and neglected, there is a very normal and natural feeling, even in cases of severe abuse and neglect, to still want to be with your parents, to want to know they're okay. That's how attachment works. You know, we're infants. We know these folks are our caregivers. We want everything for them. Many people in therapy struggle with the conflict between their anger at the abuse and neglect and this urge to still connect with that parent. It's a tough thing to navigate. I see Ed doing that here when I was watching this. She's thinking about what am I willing to let go in hopes of some kind of familial relationship that I realized I was just using these people to get, this found family on the Bebop. On the flip side, anyone who's taking life advice from Faye Valentine, you know, let's be honest here. She's not in the best place in this episode or most of the series to be giving this kind of advice.
Absolutely. I do feel like we haven't done a service to Appleberry. We're talking about him sort of as a concept and didn't really break down what he's up to. So really quick, our bounty this week was Appleberry Sinise Hessup Lutfin. Appleberry. He's 6'8". He's 466 pounds. An absolutely huge guy. And we'll see it when Spike tries to fight him. On his bounty sheet, if you will, he is wanted for breaking into a bank and causing bodily injury resulting in death. Everyone in the Bebop universe seems to be wanted for robbing a bank, by the way. Almost everybody that we see has that listed as a crime. Think it's some background stuff about the financial state of the universe, but we won't go there. Appleberry has a partner named McIntyre, and I watched this relationship very closely this episode. McIntyre is a younger guy, and I think you could paint a version of this where he's like a replacement child. He's like a son figure, but Appleberry can't even remember his name. And so we see McIntyre often literally chasing after Appleberry, like begging him to remember that his name is McIntyre. And it shows us maybe a glimpse into the type of life Ed would have if Ed joined this crew. Is her name Francois? Is it Ed? Does she even care about her dad's mission? Appleberry is fixated on mapping these craters. He believes he's bringing some sort of order to a chaotic world and saving the Earth somehow by updating geographical maps. That was sad this watch through too. His task looked really Sisyphean to me. Like, there's no point in doing this. It's infinite. So I'm not even sure this thing that he's dedicated his life nobly to is all that great to begin with.
So why do we think he's doing this?
I don't know. Why did dads get into anything? Why did dads get into Cubs games or model trains?
I mean, my read on it was that Appleberry is an academic of some kind for whom this is somewhere in his field. And he thinks if I do this, you know, I'll revolutionize the field. I will make it again. I'll be relevant. This, again, also hit differently, you know, 20 years later when we got Carol and Tuesday, and we got more hints as to the state of things, right? And they paint a pretty grim picture of Earth in Carol and Tuesday. Things are bad. The people who are left there have almost no way out.
Watanabe really doesn't like this planet, is what I'm gathering.
So it could be desperation. It could be that this is the only way Appleberry sees out.
I'd also entertain the idea, and we do not diagnose fictional characters in this house, but I'd entertain the idea that he is neurodivergent in some way and this is just what he's fixated on. I normally wouldn't think that, but given that we've already in this conversation explored the idea of a live action Ed that is canonically neurodivergent, it would make sense for it to run in the family, and they're just handling it different ways in their lives.
That was my reading of it too, and I was going to bring that up. That's the one thing I would acknowledge, is that I'm all for reading of Ed as neurodivergent, whatever that may mean, without naming a diagnosis, under that fairly large umbrella. And I think in some ways, we absolutely can see how this is Ed's father, right? It lines up just enough to keep that crux of, but Dad bailed.
So we fast-tracked the story a little bit where Jet and Spike think they're going to cash in on a quick bounty, and they meet in person, and he turns out to be an absolute unit that takes Spike out immediately. There is no fight here. There's nothing to be gained. There's not even a real bounty because Ed put the 50 Wulongs on his head.
Yes, it is a visual gag, and I went back and checked. The visual gag is present from the beginning of the episode. The bounty is 50.000000. It's a period, not a comma.
I also want to mention my favorite line from this entire episode is, sucking eggs is good for you. cool. I'll live with it.
There is a dub and sub difference here that I want to call out. And it happens when Appleberry asks Ed, do you want to live together now? There's this brief moment of seeming sincerity where he's making direct eye contact with his child and is like, all right, it can be like the good old days, just say yes. But then a new meteorite hits and he goes running off into the distance. Ed doesn't even get a chance to respond. It's so sad because you can see her thinking about it. She really wanted a moment to make the choice, and I really think she would have gone. In the dub, she doesn't say anything. She just sort of stands there staring with her teeth gritted as he rides off into the sunset with his not son. In the sub, even though her teeth are together, they fit a word in there. And she says, Chi-Chi, she's crying out father after him. And the fact that she like yells for him as he's running away in the Japanese version, it's so much worse. It made me cry.
I mean, my read of that was when Ed clicked into, oh, this is that guy I don't remember. This is something I have stopped accessing on a regular basis because it was so long ago and maybe so painful. And it's all happening over again, which, you know, makes the thing with Faye all that more powerful, that Faye convinces Ed to make a go at this in spite of Ed having immediate evidence it's going to be exactly the same.
I also want to paint some additional texture here. In the sub, they say that Appadeli left his daughter at a daycare center and just forgot which one it was. But the dub explicitly says the orphanage. And those have two different intents. Like, did he know that he would be gone for an extended period of time and that he couldn't care for his daughter, so therefore he entrusted another person to do so? Or is this just a weird case of memory lapse or neglect or what have you? But then he asks truly if Edge wants to be part of his life. And I don't think he says that lightly. It's just that there seems to be something he's incapable of when it comes to prioritizing his daughter over his personal life mission.
I think he's sincere, but I don't think sincere means what it means for him like it would mean for us. You could be a narcissist or a sociopath and say something like that and in the moment really mean it, but not be thinking about the other person's feelings or not actually be thinking about what labor this would take in the future and what this thing would actually look like if she said yes. And I feel like that's where we're at. I think he might have had a different line there if he had taken a moment to be like, okay, well, what would it be like from now on? I don't think he did that.
So before we delve into the climax of this episode and resolve a major character arc, I did want to touch base a little bit on the production values of this episode. We have Michiko Yokote, who has written several episodes already, a lot of heavy hitters. She's been like really, really good at hitting all these emotional salient points. I really appreciate that in her ongoing work on Shirobaku and Shirobaku the movie. Unfortunately, I can't really say any other titles of hers strike me like that as well, but I'd love to be wrong, listeners. please tweet us. I want your good anime references and recommendations. Another aspect of this episode are the Sakuga fight scenes with Spike and Appadelli. Like, that was actually really well done and of quality. I really appreciated the time and effort they put into making this feel weighty and meaningful when it actually had absolutely no bearing on the story whatsoever. Another aspect to this episode that's really well done is the emotional quietness and the introspection they're portraying through stills and some of the textural audio that goes in the background, the running water, these kind of like twinkle sounds from different tracks. And then we also kind of have these foreshadowing moments where, especially where Faye is in the ship and the moon cracks, it's fractured. And that's a foreshadowing of events to come when the moon actually does fracture through the space gate explosion. The last bit, and I know we'll get into it, is the irony that only when the family is fractured, the Bebop is disassembled, that there's enough to eat. And that, oh man, that brings us into the final bits.
The episode reaches its peak with Faye and Ed simultaneously resolving their character arcs. Faye goes running up a hill toward her childhood home and finds it gone. I think we're to assume that, like so many things on this planet, with all of the destruction from meteors and from the lack of care, and as Brian said, the lack of government, it just fell into disarray. Nobody was there to care for this building anymore, so she doesn't have a home to go back to. Ed, acknowledging that her home is not with her father, decides to find belonging somewhere. I'm not sure where she's going. That's another difference from when I watched it when I was younger. It felt like a much more sure and wise decision on her part, but I don't think it's clear what her destination is. And because she doesn't know, that's why she says Ayn can't come with her. It would be a really dangerous, I think, prospect to bring an animal along when you don't know how long you'll be journeying, you don't know where. But Ayn chooses Ed. And as a dog person, that definitely brought tears to my eyes. It certainly is made more affecting by the fact that Call Me, Call Me is playing, which is my favorite song in all of Cowboy Bebop. You've heard me talk about it many times on this podcast before. It really juxtaposes against, like, who are these characters going to call? Where are they going? What's now for them? I think there's more Faye's story to be told, and there's more Ed's story to be told. This didn't feel like the end for either of them, this watch through, but there isn't anything else. But Brian, if we did have more episodes of Cowboy Bebop, and we did have more time with these characters, what happens to Faye now? How can she continue to heal and grow after these experiences?
I think at this point, Faye, for the first time in her new life, is really going to get to grieve the life she had. She doesn't know what she's lost for 5 years. And grief is a really important process for us. Grief is the way our brains handle things in our lives changing that are painful and making sense of a new world and a new life after that thing is gone. And that can be relationships, people, a job, a pet, anything. She struggled really hard to trust people and to attach them in really healthy ways. I think this episode is the first time we see her begin a real conscious effort with that when she apologizes to Spike for her behavior. That said, though, she's got a pretty big hill to climb. There's still a lot of trauma she needs to deal with. She's going to have to figure out what her better and healthier boundaries are. She has to find better ways to cope with problems, and that's going to be a long journey for her. And if she can find some folks that will support her, that she can trust and be secure in, she's got a pretty good outlook.
This entire scene is so climactic and impactful, and like, I bawl my eyes out every single time. In fact, when I watched through the second time for our notes on the show, I was tearing up again, even at double speed. So I will say that the dog interaction definitely brings a bigger tear to my eye. Watson was in the room when I was watching that little scene of I'm hopping along after Ed and being really excited to join her on her new adventures. But why do we think viewers are so emotionally sensitive to these kinds of things? Like, we have Hachiko's story in Japan. We have the whole premise of John Wick. We have Twitter accounts, can you pet the dog and does the doggy die? Can we unbox this for a second?
What is there to unbox? Dogs are just all good. They're good and pure and they love us and we love them back.
It's accurate, but there actually is a scientific explanation for this.
Booyah!
I'm really glad you asked this question. So this is a fun area of both epigenetics and coevolution. So epigenetics is the way our genes and our environment interact to produce different effects. And coevolution is one of the big pictures of those, right? We co-evolve with another entity. In this case, humans have co-evolved with dogs. And this has gotten so intertwined that when you do fMRI scans of dog brains showing them caregivers and humans showing them, you know, a dog, the parts of the brain that light up in both are the same kinds that light up for a parent. So the same kind of light up you get from a human who's looking at their mother or father for in terms of attachment and having those warm, fuzzy feelings I talked about earlier of really deeply wanting good things from your parent, even if you know that's not going to happen, those light up when we see dogs. And for dogs, those light up when they see their caregiver, humans. So our brains react in very specific ways to dogs. Now, of course, you know, negative experiences with a dog or negative experiences for a dog with a human can change these responses, of course, but our default is to like dogs.
I actually did know some of this. You're reminding me. If listeners at home, you want to hear more about the actual science, check out the book How Dogs Love Us by neuroscientist Gregory Burns. I met him at Dragon Con many years back when he was promoting his book when it was new. And it's literally about these studies they did to find out these brain reactions from these animals. But what's fascinating about it is that they wanted to make sure the study was consensual, or as close to consensual as you can get when studying dogs. And so a large portion of the book is about the training that they put these dogs through to have them voluntarily sit inside whatever MRI or CAT scan, I don't remember, but to sit inside these large and terrifying machines that are completely foreign to dogs and to want to do it and to feel rewarded by participating in the study. And then he did, in fact, find out what Brian just told us. It is a touching scientific book.
I like to think that when Watson's watching this episode alongside me, all those good feel like areas in his brain are lighting up. And he would follow me like Ein followed Ed across the surface of the planet to unknown adventures.
I can't imagine the writers for this episode had any idea of this. I'm pretty sure that research is well before this was written. I remember it's something in the past 10 years they've really come up with. It adds another fun layer to it. Ein sees Ed as a caregiver. Ein trusts Ed. Ein is going to go with Ed and choose Ed. In some ways, because Ed has proven to be a better caregiver than Ed's father was. Ed is giving Ein a choice to remain somewhere safe and stable that can meet Ein's needs in ways Ed can't.
And Ein has historically been validated through Ed's interaction with him, right? Like, she's likely the only character on the ship that really understands his intelligence and what he's capable of. And that brings a conclusion to Ed and Ein. I'm so sad.
Yeah, the timing of this watch was very coincidental for me. I logged onto Reddit shortly after consuming it and saw that someone had gotten a tattoo of the bye-bye painting that Ed leaves on the deck of the Bebop. And I thought that was a stellar, stellar tribute to Cowboy Bebop. So many people get the swordfish or a very like on-the-nose picture of Spike or of Faye. And that sort of brush-strokey bye-bye, what a fantastic way to capture like a high specific moment from the series. Whoever you are with that tattoo, I hope you're listening. You rock my socks.
I think my tattoo would be a basket of eggs.
I did think of you during that scene. I was like, Jamie, my egg fan Jamie is going to love this part so much.
I am egg. That actual scene of Spike and Jet eating Faye and Ed's dinner is a reference to the film Cool Hand Luke, in which, quote, the protagonist Luke is challenged to eat 50 hard-boiled eggs in 1 hour.
I saw that the wiki said that that was a reference. I guess I want to believe that they did their homework, but is it a tribute or is it just another scene where people ate a bunch of eggs at once? Like, not everything has to be a tribute. Maybe it's just a time when people ate a bunch of eggs and it's not about other media.
I don't know. My first thought watching that now was really thinking about Jed knows how to cook, and the best he can do with these eggs is hard boil them. This is, I'm confused by this. I have trouble believing this. He could do so much more with these.
They
eggs.
Last longer.
They do, but like just eat them just straight up, not with like a soup, not.
I think that's the joke, actually. I think maybe they were hard boiled with the intent of later putting them into ramen or later putting them on top of bread. But now they just have to eat their feelings, which is its own mental health coping mechanism for sure.
So we have come to the end of two major characters' story arcs. All the things that were driving them through the entire show have been resolved, even if we didn't even know there was stuff about Ed driving her as well. So a couple of questions. Whose journey on the Bebop sticks with you most, and what contributing elements make that so for you? And whose journey needs a redo? How can we do that better in 2021?
So this is a tough one for me. Faye was always a big favorite, but I really appreciated Spike's narrative where he clearly knows this will not end well. We know that from episode one. He knows life is going to be nasty, brutish, and short, but he's continuing on anyways towards these things he wants and loves. So I've always been a big fan of his, but gosh, the Faye episodes, they hit so hard. We can all identify with, you know, wanting to know who we are, where we're going, where we belong. And I think Faye's one of those rare characters where the writers let us see how messy that is and that you're not going to always have an answer.
Yeah, I feel that one. I would say for me, Ed's journey starts, and she doesn't even realize what's going on or like the reality of her situation. It just kind of rolls off her and she takes it as it is. But now she has someone in her life. She has Ayn, who's going to stick with her through thick and thin. And that just makes it even more salient for me. She has someone that looks in on her and keeps her company and acts as a pillow. And just, I'm so glad that their stories ended up together, intertwined.
My answer to both questions, who has my favorite journey and who could use a redo, is Jet Black. He is both. I really love in the anime how we find out over time that he's sort of an unreliable narrator. Whether or not that was intentional by the anime's writers, I'm not sure, but it worked out really well. He starts out by saying he got out of the ISSP because of corruption, but then little by little, we start to see the tragedies of his past, from losing a love to losing his arm and the ways he just refuses to let go of his trauma or process it in a healthy way. It wasn't just, the police, it got too corrupt. A lot happened to him that gets shared with us as a slow burn. I love his journey. I do also, though, think that a cop with a heart of gold story is not one I necessarily want to see in 2021. And a version of Jet that really confronts police brutality in America or police overfunding and the extremely real, violently oppressive issues that are caused by police. We have to do something with that.
Yeah. I mean, I think I mentioned it earlier, my hope for the Netflix remake for more nuance is definitely Ed getting more detail and care. But yeah, I think especially after the way Carolyn Tuesday and those writers even address some very more relevant issues around poverty and inequality and the way media works. And, you know, just recently in the anime, they were very explicit, takes place on the same Mars. Netflix would be, it would be a bad choice to not address some of the police aspects to Jet's character and the ways Jet could be used as a character to talk about how we could do better.
I'm on board with Jet's redo. I think it's time.
Well, we're about out of time. Hey, hey. So before we go, Brian, we've had an amazing time hanging out with you. You've added so much to this discussion. It was everything we hoped for. If our listeners wanted to find you online or get to know you better, see your work, where would you like them to go?
Well, definitely check out GamerX, GAYMERX. We are at GamerX on Twitter. We are at GamerX.org. Once we are back into the normal times, we'll be trying very hard to be back at shows like PAX, providing panels about queer content in games, tabling. We hope to be back at Game Developers Conference this spring as well. Fingers crossed. As far as me, you can find me on Twitter at No World For Tomorrow, but it's NOWORLDFORTMMRW. Definitely check out that one. Kind of keep up with the things I'm doing. I work with GamerX. I have my own practice. I do work with Take This on certain projects. And my Twitter is usually where I put all the stuff I'm currently doing.
Thanks again for joining us, Brian. It's been a real treat.
Thanks for having me. It was a blast.
Thank you for joining us, Bounty Hunters. We are about to tackle the Real Folk Blues Part 1 and 2. Thank you for listening to the Bebop Beat. If you like our show, please rate us on Apple or wherever you find your podcasts. Find us on Instagram and Twitter at Bebop Beat. Our email address is bebopbeatpodcast@gmail.com.
The Bebop Beat is hosted and produced by Jamie Sanchez and Lauren Fates. Our editor and associate producer is Angela Geis. Our logo and art assets are by Kat Janda.
Having a powerful dog episode.
They know what's coming.